Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown. Welcome to Focus on Africa. Our conversations today include this one.
Are you people telling me that the work clock broke itself? Eh? It broke itself!
Daddy, are you also trying to say that it is impossible for the clock to fall down itself and break?
Yes! That is very possible, especially if the clock is diagonally placed or on a diagonal angle.
If you don't know, you go know. To quote Fela, I'm talking about The Johnsons, one of Africa's best-loved sitcoms, which is coming to an end after 13 glorious years on air. Kenya is becoming a major route through which people are being trafficked to the south.
Many of those who are trafficked are often in vehicles, and it looks very legitimate as they cross the border. But of course, the intention of those behind the trafficking is to move these individuals through Kenya and onto Tanzania, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Zambia, with the view of getting to South Africa ultimately.
And the Church of England has been discussing how to raise £1 billion to make amends for its role in the slave trade. It's Tuesday, the 5th of March. First, we go to Nairobi. Kenya is one of the major hubs on the continent, connecting us to the rest of the world via air transport especially. But it is this very connectivity that exposes the country to being a route of choice for smuggling and people trafficking. The International Organization for Migration says Kenya is now a common transit route for undocumented migrant workers to try and reach the southern tip of the continent, South Africa, where they believe they'll find work. A few days ago, the Kenyan authorities found 37 Ethiopians in a house in Nairobi waiting to be trafficked south. Four police officers were arrested on suspicion of aiding the smugglers. Yvonne Ndege is the regional information officer for the IOM's East and Horn of Africa region.
Kenya is one of the main countries this issue is affecting, but it also touches Malawi, Mozambique, Tanzania, Zambia, Zimbabwe, where we've seen cases of migrants being trafficked, abused, and exploited by their handlers. Now, why Kenya? Well, the answer is quite simple if you know this region. Kenya shares a border with both Ethiopia and Somalia, where most of the victims come from. And so it's the first country of transit that traffickers basically exploit. Borders, particularly in this part of the continent, are porous, as I know you know well. Migrants traveling along the southern route, now that's from the Horn of Africa down to southern Africa, cross into Kenya because it's the nearest access point at the Moyale border. And there are some unmanned points near these border areas or near this particular border area. And those seeking to exploit migrant workers obviously make strenuous efforts to avoid detection by Kenya's immigration and border officials. So although Ethiopia and Kenya in particular do have a bilateral agreement on free movement, the majority of migrants cross the border irregularly, or what we would say is without the correct papers or documentation, with the help of smugglers. Just looking at the IOM data, just to give people a sense of the scale of this issue, as of November last year, at least almost 11,000 migrants were tracked moving along this border. And again, I want to draw attention to the fact that this route is fraught with so many dangers, and it's important to remember that these migrant workers are just looking for a better life opportunities, and then they become these victims of trafficking, and at times it ends in total tragedy.
The reason why we're talking about this is because a few days ago, the Kenyan authorities found 37 Ethiopian nationals in a house in Nairobi. Four police officers were suspected of aiding human smuggling. How do people move? Do they go in trucks? Do they walk? And what are the dangers that they face?
We're talking about a very long and very porous border, a border where we see exploitation by traffickers. Remember, these borders do have official routes, okay? People are moving between, for instance, Ethiopia and Kenya in Moyale absolutely legitimately on a daily basis, and traffickers exploit and can exploit these systems that are in place. We have found that many of those who are trafficked or being smuggled are often in vehicles. It is unusual to find people on foot, and on the face of it, maybe initially, it looks very legitimate as they cross the border. But of course, the intention of those behind the trafficking is to move these individuals irregularly through Kenya and onto the other countries I mentioned, Tanzania, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Zambia, with the view of getting to South Africa ultimately.
That's what I'm interested in finding out. So how do they get from Kenya down through these various countries and into South Africa?
Well, from the evidence that IOM has seen, most of those who are being exploited, the migrants who are being exploited, are being moved in vehicles and trucks. And I pointed to three tragedies in which over 100 died. They were all involved in some sort of vehicle movement, or they were in some sort of truck, or they were abandoned in some sort of truck. Now, what are the dangers they face? The dangers are very clear. Obviously, if you are locked up in a truck without air, food, or water, you're likely to die. And that has happened. They're completely at the mercy of those who are trafficking and exploiting them.
From the research and perhaps interviews that IOM might have had with people who are being returned or, you know, have been rescued from the callous hands of traffickers, are they aware of the issues that they face when they get to South Africa? I mean, South Africa, a well-known, very high rate of joblessness, xenophobic attacks and so on, that it's not necessarily the Mecca that people are expecting.
Many of the migrants are coming from the most vulnerable communities in the countries of origin. They may not be educated, they may not be well informed, they may not have the economic resources to move regularly. And they are unaware, very unaware in most instances, the research of IOM, the International Organization for Migration, has found, of the socioeconomic conditions in those countries of destination. IOM in Ethiopia, in Somalia, Kenya, and in Southern African countries, including South Africa, works with various governments to try and raise awareness about the issues and the risks of being trafficked. But reducing the vulnerability of migrants to trafficking in the country of origin, in the countries of transit, and in the country of destination is also partly dependent on there being strong national policy and legal frameworks in all those countries that respect, protect, and fulfill the human rights and fundamental freedoms of all migrants at all stages of their journeys, regardless of their migration status. So regardless of whether they have the documentation or not.
Is Kenya being used as a staging post for trafficking to other destinations?
Yes, we do see evidence of there being not just the southern route. We also see this on the eastern route, which is now moving up from the Horn of Africa through Djibouti, across the Gulf of Aden, into Yemen, up to the border with Saudi Arabia, where many, many thousands of mainly young people from the Horn of Africa are looking for work and job opportunities. They want to get to the Gulf countries. They want to get to Saudi Arabia. And we see them, some of the traffickers, using not just Kenya, but other countries as well, Ethiopia, Somalia, Djibouti, to try to exploit migrant workers, again, as I said, taking them across the Gulf of Aden, selling them the hope, selling them the dream that they will get to the Gulf and get decent work and opportunity. And the dangers there are as perilous as the ones described on the southern route.
That's Yvonne Ndege, the Regional Information Officer for the International Organization for Migration's East and Horn of Africa region. Now to a story about attempts by the Church of England to address its role in the slave trade. It's something of a contentious issue both here and in the US, with many voices raised saying it's time to move on. Others have been campaigning for years for recognition of the damage done by a trade that lasted hundreds of years, leaving deep wounds between the people who were exploited in this way and the people who perpetrated the trade. Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, said in 2022 that he was deeply sorry for the church's links to slavery. What followed from that apology was an investigation into just how the church was involved. It was led by what's called the Oversight Group, which found that the church had invested large sums of money into a company that transported enslaved people from the continent to the Americas. All of this was revealed at a press conference here in London. Our Daniel Dadzi was there.
The press conference was held by the Church Commissioners, which is the investment and financing arm of the Church of England. And this organization began in 1704. They were set up as Queen Anne's Bounty to help poor clergy. Research was commissioned in 2019 to figure out some elements of the Church Commissioners' history. And it was discovered that there were specific links to slavery. Since then, our understanding from the news conference is they have embarked on a journey to try and repair that wrong. And this is one of the ways that they're seeking to do that, by setting up an impact investment fund.
Daniel, let's understand exactly what were the links that the Church of England had to the slave trade. Did they, for instance, own enslaved people, you know, as a body? What is it that they are seeking to address?
The information presented was that Queen Anne invested in the slave trade, holding 22.5% of stock in the South Sea Company.
And when was that?
This was between 1715 and 1731. The South Sea Company was responsible for the transportation of about 64,000 African slaves. So that is the specific link. Of course, the Queen Anne's Bounty is what is now the Church Commissioners.
So the church's response was to earmark £100 million pounds for repairing this damage caused by slavery. But then there was a response to that amount. What were people saying?
This oversight group was formed to look further into how exactly this would be used and what exactly should be done with that amount. And the oversight group found that the £100 million pounds that was earmarked initially would not be enough. They decided to set up a £1 billion pound investment fund. And that would begin with an initial 100 million from the Church Commissioners, and they are hoping to raise the remaining 900 million from other partners.
I'm actually struck by the fact that the church feels that it needs to respond in this way. How are they going to use the money?
Our understanding is that it will go into investing in businesses that are owned primarily by Black people. That's Africans in the diaspora and hopefully Africans on the continent as well. Let's hear from Geetha Gamaratnam, who is a member of this oversight group that was set up by the Church Commissioners.
The areas of interest around the fund are healthy lives, both mental health as well as physical health. It is thriving minds, it's education, it is access to food systems, it is also access to land, and finally we look at intersectionality. As we look at access to funding for Black entrepreneurs, it is even further exacerbated by access to funding which is going to Black women entrepreneurs.
Daniel, I'm interested in where the money will come from and how has this gone down in this country, because we know that there's a lot of contention around the issue of reparations, because essentially this is what we're talking about, but also many people saying that whatever amount of money any of the major institutions that did benefit from trading in the slave trade, it cannot possibly compensate for the damage that was done.
That admission was made, that no amount of money will be enough to compensate. The oversight group was very specific to try and delineate what they're doing from reparations, because the approach that a lot of people take to reparations is that it's a compensation that is mainly monetary. According to Bishop Rosemary Mallett, who was the head of the committee, even though repair is a part of it, it does not necessarily equate reparations, and they are looking to do something wider than the money on its own. The critique really has been that the endowment of the Church Commissioners is much larger than £1 billion, and the Church Commissioners actually has within its power to provide more than even the 100 million seed fund that they are bringing up. Gareth Munster, the chief executive of the Church Commissioners.
Church Commissioners thought long and hard about how it made an appropriate response and determined to invest £100 million in this response so that it was a significant and really impactful amount, but at the same time, making sure the Church Commissioners could honour all of our existing commitments to support the work of the Church of England. Over the next 9 years, we'll spend £3.6 billion in supporting the Church of England's work. So it's important that we wanted to make this fund significant enough to have impact, but also we had to still honour all of our existing commitments.
Is there a time period over which this is going to happen?
Yes, the initial £100 million is going to be invested over the next 5 years. Again, this is another change because last year it was announced that it would be invested over 9 years. But the oversight group that looked into it said the 9 years was too long.
What about amongst groups that have been calling for reparations, that have been calling for restoration? What have they been saying?
So a member of the all-party parliamentary group here in the UK's parliament for reparations for the African continent was actually in the oversight group. When I spoke to her personally about how this fits in to the bigger conversation of reparations, her point was that views from across the world have been taken to find a response that would be appropriate. So one of the questions I asked during the press conference was whether or not state partners, that is governments on the continent, have been consulted in setting this fund up. And this is the response I had.
So far, there has not been an engagement of state partners. I think the opportunities for engagement with communities, first and foremost, that has been a big part of our consideration. We are still early in this journey. And so there is scope for engagement, which is far broader than it has been right now.
That was Bishop Rosemary Mallett, who chaired the oversight group, ending that conversation that I had with Daniel Dadzi. I don't know if you know the Johnsons. If you don't, better get with the program quickly, because this sitcom, much loved by Nigeria and many others across the continent, is coming to an end after 13 raucous, glorious years. The show is known for its satirical, humorous take on the challenges faced by a middle-class family in Lagos. Charles Inoji is the main character and director of the series. We had a very enjoyable conversation about the point of the show and why it became so popular. We began with a taste of a typical scene in The Johnsons.
Like an angel in the morning.
You won't put me inside. You don't invite them.
Like shooting star across the night. The most beautiful galaxy in all my life.
What's happening this one? Hey, who you be? I hope I never collect bright prize.
It was on for 13 years and it just built on an audience and grew and grew and grew. Why do you think it was that popular? What was going on in Nigeria and what was going on in the sitcom that people responded to?
Much of the popularity of the show derived from the fact that it dealt with everyday situations. In fact, many people describe the Johnsons as a portrayal of the average African father one and average African home. The situations, subject matters, and themes that we deal with on a daily basis on the show are issues that almost every family can relate to. And I think that was how it got its popularity. Another point that also helped its popularity is the fact that it was the only show on television that was truly, truly a family show. Clean comedy. It was the only show that any parent could allow their kids to watch alone without fears of, as it regards strong language, violence, you know, all of the sorts that most people would frown at. We had the largest fan base amongst children. They are the ones who eventually initiate their parents into their fan community.
That's really interesting that they see it that way. Why were they called the Johnsons?
The main character is Lucky Johnson. That's my character, yeah. So every member of the family just summed it up to be the Johnsons.
Tell me this. He decides when something is unnecessary, right? And the other members of the family don't necessarily agree with them. But tell us about the teenagers in the show. What sort of characters are they? The ones that I think are the ones that draw the children into watching.
most of the time, some family members just want to spend money, not knowing that the father who makes this money doesn't pluck them from a tree. So it is therefore very important that he spends in a way that when things go awry and the earnings are not coming as they used to, there's still something for everybody to fall back on. As for the children, we had them all, from the very intelligent Ifetobori, in fact, a genius, if you like, to Tari, who has no interest in education, in fact, from his, yeah, what I would do with that character is to encourage parents who may have special children to watch them closely and know where their interest lies and encourage them along that line. And yet, they will turn out just as good as those pairs who went to the university.
Okay, let's listen to another clip from the sitcom and then we can talk about that as well.
Are you people telling me that the work clock broke itself? Eh? It broke itself!
Daddy, are you also trying to say that it is impossible for the clock to fall down itself and break?
Yes! Jennifer, that is what I am saying.
No, Daddy!
It is impossible!
Daddy, no, it's possible.
Yes, Daddy, it's very possible, especially if the clock is diagonally placed or on a diagonal angle.
Daddy?
Sir?
If you don't behave yourself, Daddy, if you let me give you a diagonal slap, your mouth will be permanently shut diagonally.
There's the threat of violence in that. I'll slap you and your mouth will be diagonal forever or something like that. How did you deal with that? Because, I mean, these days, that kind of language is challenged, isn't it? And that kind of treatment of children.
Yes. Lucky Johnson is a father that believes that if you spare the rod, you spoil the child. And that, if you ask me, is more like a doctrine in every African home. The cane is a very active member of every African home. When a child falls out of line, you bring him back to his senses. You may not use the cane, as in physically use the cane to flog the child.
So did you depict that on the screen or did you do it in earlier years and then you sort of just use the threat of it in later episodes and in later years?
On the Johnsons, the cane was an active member of the family.
Right, okay. Talk to us about your wife. Her name is Emu, right? She's a very strong woman.
Yes, Emu is, she sensationalizes everything, but she's a loving wife. She probably is the direct opposite of the husband, Lucky Johnson.
Right. Why is this series coming to an end, given that it was so popular?
I think in answering that, I'll first say every show owes its life to the whims and caprices of the producer. The show was owned by Africa Magic. I don't have any explanation to that. Nobody has given us any explanation as to why they ended the show. But for me, that is really not a problem. I would rather celebrate the 13 years of popularity the show enjoyed amongst the African viewing audience.
What sort of reaction has there been?
People are disappointed. People are asking why. People are asking, after the Johnsons, what next? What are they then going to be watching?
Charles Inoji, director and main actor in The Johnsons, now sadly about to disappear from our screens. Today's producers were Bella Hassan, Lola Schroyer, and Daniel Dadzi. Our efforts were guided by Patricia Whitehorn. Johnny Hall was our technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Ushri Brown. We'll talk again next time.
As we mark International Women's Day, discover two podcasts from the BBC World Service, celebrating women around the world. Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for season 3. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.